I'm Jonathan Aberman. Coming up on today's show.
So one of the things that my lab's really interested in is, you know, I've done a lot of research that sort of maps out how creativity happens in brains, at least certain forms of creativity that we've focused on. But we can do more than just observe.
Welcome to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.
As you know, if you listen to the show, I really am very concerned about what the role of humans is going to be in the workforce now that we have AI becoming more and more sophisticated. Well, I brought in the studio today an expert who studies cognition and creativity and how the mind works. And what he has to say about how humans think and how we are creative is frankly very, very reassuring as we look at these big issues. Adam Green is a professor at Georgetown University. He's the director of the Laboratory for Relational Cognition, a national expert on how the mind works and what creativity is. Here's our conversation. Adam, it's great to have you.
Good to see you, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
You and I were together a number of months ago. We were talking about the role of creativity, particularly in the world of growing reliance upon technology. And I was fascinated by how you approached it. Let's start with the basics. You're involved now in trying to understand what makes people creative.
You know, for me, it started with, you know, having a good high school teacher and a good set of books at home that my dad had on the shelf about just basic questions about everything from religion to philosophy, and bringing in notions of these big questions, and starting then as you go out into the world a little bit, and you start to, you know, figure out what the different disciplines for future for yourself might be if you want to go into science, starting to look at, well, these are big questions, but maybe there are ways to study them that give us hard answers, not just big, broad generalities, right? So that was always appealing to me. And so that took me in a couple of directions. Really, my training is neuroscience. So I'm a cognitive neuroscientist.
What does that mean?
So what that means, right? What does that mean?
It means what does that mean? I'd like to know, Adam.
On different days, I can tell you that much. It's like every other job, I guess. But what it means is you start with big questions like, what is creativity? Or, you know, what is emotion? Or what is attention? What is learning? And instead of just sort of pondering those questions as big, general, you know, abstractions, you start to say, okay, well, we can't ask that question all at once. But what we could do is ask some piece of that question. Let's take some particular task where people get to be creative. We ask them, how do you use a brick? What are all the different ways you could use a brick, right? Or we have them, you know, look at a bunch of words and we say, which words are connected? And we look to see if they make connections between words that are far apart in terms of their superficial meaning. Lots of these different things, none of which on its own is the whole idea, is the whole enchilada. But what we're doing is we're taking these big abstract questions and we're starting to break them down into questions you can ask with science, and particularly questions you can ask with neuroscience. And these days, cognitive neuroscience asks those questions by having people do some little task that's part of some big concept, some big construct like creativity, and watch what happens in the brain when they do it, right? So there's a lot now, a lot of modes, a lot of methods of neuroimaging. So my lab, a lot of our work is based on functional MRI. So we watch and we see where blood is flowing and in what networks there's activity when you're doing a particular kind of creativity.
Again, I just find the idea that we're able to map the physiology of a brain and understand the mechanics of it. That in itself, I think, is a really fascinating and important thing. I want to, before we go a bit further, though, I want to acknowledge that, first of all, you identified creativity, but I think a lot of what you identified it as initially, I would call curiosity.
Sure.
Is curiosity necessarily creativity, or is it something different?
I'm glad you're so curious about that, Jonathan.
I am. That's why we're here today.
You're such a creative guy. Yeah. I recently had a conversation with a colleague of mine who considers himself a creativity researcher. And what he studies is question asking, right? And he believes, and I think he's right, that there's that a lot of our creativity comes in the kinds of questions that we dream up. And in fact, one of the things that I, with a different colleague that we've recently had the opportunity to do, is build a test. This was something that was funded by the National Science Foundation. Build a test of scientific creativity for kids who are in school, middle schoolers primarily. And one of the things that we focused on in that, in building that test, is what are, if you give a middle schooler some scenario, like you land on a new planet, or you you find some artifact uncovered, you know, deep in the earth, what are the questions that you would ask? And so I'm a big believer that curiosity and question asking is a big part of creativity. And it's especially an important part of scientific creativity, because that's what gets a lot of us here. We're just curious. We're so curious. We can't stop asking these questions. When we're kids, we won't leave our parents alone on the car ride. You know, we're asking why and when and how. And then eventually, if you want to do that for a living, science is a great way to do it for a living. Because basically that becomes the job, is to ask questions.
It seems to me that you're also touching on an area that people tend to think of as philosophy. You know, when I think about Aristotle, Socrates, Aquinas, and more recent thinkers, the idea of what makes us who we are, you know, these big life questions, it sounds to me like there's a lot of overlap in your scientific work with what traditionally would be philosophy.
So that's exactly right. At least to me, that is exactly the right way to frame it. So growing up, reading books on philosophy, that's how I got interested in asking these same questions, but asking them with new tools. At Georgetown now, my favorite class, and no offense to students who've taken other classes with me, but my favorite class that I teach is a class called Neurophilosophy that I just kind of got to make up. And what we do in this class is we read old texts where people ask big questions that have always puzzled humans. And then we read papers from cognitive neuroscience from the last, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, where people have asked not the whole question, but meaningful chunks of those big questions by using the tools of neuroscience. So basically, I think that cognitive neuroscience, very much as you're suggesting, is the current incarnation of philosophy in some ways, right? It can't do all the things that philosophy can do. And some of my most valued colleagues are philosophers, and they don't want to be neuroscientists. But I think that the more enlightened among them view cognitive neuroscience in its sort of present form as an extension of philosophy.
That's interesting, because when I think about the two, having benefited from a liberal arts education, where I studied a lot of philosophy, and that was a lot of my education, many of the people that I learned from felt like learning about the arts, the liberal arts, was a higher calling. It was a very artistic activity. And they would look at what you were doing, mapping the brain, using MRIs, as a very material-driven activity. So I find it interesting to hear you say that your colleagues are able to bridge the gap. So talk about that. I think that's really important in the because we live in a technological world now where, frankly, and we're going to get to this, one of the big questions is, what's the role of humans and AI, which is fundamentally a technology, human spirit kind of conversation to different people. So how does it bridge when you talk with somebody who's spent his or her life studying Aquinas and understanding the deepest questions, for example?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And there's a really important word that comes up a lot in those discussions. And that word is reductionism, right? Or sometimes people will say, if you're looking at the brain and you're asking a question about some deep philosophical notion, isn't that reductive, right? And I think it's really important to think about what we mean by the word reductive, and actually what reduction in the scientific sense actually means. So when we think about reduced, it's like, oh, I got less, right? I reduced that. That's worse. What reduction actually means in the scientific sense is that we are going to focus the lens. We're going to narrow the lens. We're, instead of looking at the whole thing, we're going to look at a part of the thing. A metaphor that I think is useful is, if you love cars, if you love a Ferrari, It's a beautiful, beautiful car. It's moving, right? It's emotionally, if you're a car lover, it has an emotional effect on you. You can experience it and enjoy it at that level, at that level of just the pure abstract beauty and feeling. But if you also reduce, if you also narrow the lens and you figure out how does a Ferrari work, right? By understanding the details and understanding how it was, the details, not only of the engine and what makes it move, but even the design itself, the chassis, the body, all the beautiful elements of it. Does that diminish the beauty of the car in any way? It does. It's simply a different level of description. To me, there's a great deal of beauty in being able to reach that sort of insight, that sort of understanding. So to me, there's beauty at the big level and beauty at the small level, and one really doesn't interfere with the other.
I think as I consider what you're saying, and the Ferrari example is, I think, a terrific example, because there is something very emotive about a really excellent design. When you think about some of the things that we react to, there's an emotional engagement that people have with any sort of creative output. You don't necessarily know why, say, a Ferrari's line is so emotive. Is it the red color? Is it the sound of the V12 engine? Or right. Why is it that a Roman column emotes certain things when you see it on a bank building? And we could go on and on. So you're able to start to understand through cognition how people think creatively. I assume that means that you start to understand and can see how and why people react to stimuli in certain creative ways.
So. That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, so one of the things that my lab's really interested in is, so we've going back to, you know, my grad school days and postdoc days, I've been doing, you know, I've done a lot of research that sort of maps out how creativity happens in brains, right? At least certain forms of creativity that we've focused on. But one thing that we've really transitioned into, and a lot of the field of creativity neuroscience is transitioning toward now, is to say, okay, well, we've learned a lot of this. There's plenty more to learn. There's much, much more to learn. But taking what we've already learned, we can do more than just observe, right? So now we understand if these are the systems that help brains think more creatively, there are ways that we can help these systems do that job. So there are ways of stimulating in sort of targeted, safe methods that allow us to enhance creativity directly in the brain. And that's something that my lab's been very involved in.
And when we come back after the break, I want to follow up with that and also tighten the noose a bit around how we can take understanding our creativity and apply it in the modern times so that we can help people work better with AI. I'm here with Adam Green, Professor Adam Green at Georgetown University. We'll be right back. Hearing from our listeners. You put us in touch with some of the best voices in the Washington, D.C. region. We've been hearing from you and speaking to the people you want to hear from. That's what What's Working in Washington is about. We talk to the power players about innovation in the federal government and how business in the region is keeping us competitive. But more and more, we talk about the hard questions and look for the real answers that will drive the region and our nation forward. If you know someone we should be talking to on our show, do let us know. We look to shine a spotlight on people who are really getting things done in the region. So please keep those ideas coming. And thanks to all of you who stay in touch with us. And we're back with Adam Green, professor at Georgetown University and director of the Laboratory for Relational Cognition. People really concerned that AI is going to render us in many ways obsolete. How does creativity and the work you're doing, how will it help humans push back or find a role in an AI-driven world?
You know, Jonathan, all is not lost. So I'll start with reassuring everyone that about that, at least not yet. You know, there's no telling what the future holds. But what we see so far with AI, with generative AI, is that there are some real meaningful differences between what something like ChatGPT is doing and what we're doing. So there's a few ways to talk about it. One way would just be to look under the hood, you know, to sort of extend our Ferrari metaphor, to look under the hood and look at how brains actually develop creative ideas and compare that to how something like ChatGPT actually produces a response that sounds creative to humans. And right from the jump, they are just drastically different. So at a process level, what ChatGPT, what generative AI is doing is very, very different from how brains are built, from anything brains do. So what does that mean at a product level, right? At the level of like, well, this was the output. So there's a few things. One thing I can tell you that comes from some data that that my lab has recently found, some results that a student of mine recently presented at a conference, is that when you get a bunch of humans to produce some written text. So this could be short stories, little creative short stories, or this could be something else that we've looked at, which is a big set of college admissions essays, right? If you get a big group of humans, we looked at 1,000, right? If you get a big group of humans to produce some written output, and then you ask ChatGPT, say, hey, ChatGPT, write me 1,000 short stories, write me 1,000 college admissions essays. ChatGPT can do that, right? And it'll produce, you know, the full set of 1,000. So the question then becomes, how do you look at 1,000 versus 1,000, right? And what we were interested in doing is asking basically, is there more variety of thinking? Are the kinds of thoughts that go into the big set of essays that ChatGPT produces, or the big set of short stories that ChatGPT produces, is there a variety of the kinds of thinking that ChatGPT, quote unquote thinking, that ChatGPT is doing versus humans? And what we found is that in a big group, you start to see more and more differences in the amount of variety. So that when you have what generative AI is doing is ultimately limiting what a thought can be, right? So it's homogenizing thought into a more constrained set of ideas, the things that it's trained on. And if you think about how generative AI works, this is not so surprising. It is ultimately trained on a big but ultimately limited set of ideas that it combines in a somewhat limited way.
So that's interesting, because I think that I've often said it in print and on the show that humanity's best hope is that we're able to think out of the box. We are able to think of new things, and that ultimately, no matter how sophisticated these large language models are, they're designed to get to a mean response, right? I mean, that's the whole point of it. I'm very glad to hear that your data supports my prejudice.
Yeah. And you know, I think one of the things that was really interesting about those data is that we found that so when you add one more human essay or short story to the pile, it would increase the variety more than adding one more GPT essay or short story to the pile. But that was especially true, interestingly enough, if the human was from an underrepresented minority background. So this also points to the diversity of who we include in our organizations as being sort of an important reflection and an important driver of the diversity of thought, and that generative AI is sort of homogenized. That's one of the ways in which generative AI would be homogenizing that diversity of thought.
That's fascinating. So effectively, what technology like this does, it creates a monoculture or a mono thinking in an organization, or however you want to describe it, and you can keep giving these models more data to ingest, but it's always going to regress to the mean, which means that it sounds to me like true insights, the world changing insights, are going to still be the realm of humans. But I think that's wonderful news. So, okay, I feel much better than I did 20 minutes ago. Thank you for that.
Well, I mean, there's some caveats there. What I would say is that we have to be careful that, like, if we rewind to 1995 and we scroll the, we search the web, we could come away pretty unimpressed, right? Oh, this internet thing, it's really not, it's pretty limited. It's not going to do that much, right? So it's too early, I think, to make long range projections about what these sort of models are going to achieve. But I do think when we look at process, right, we can take some heart in the idea that the process is fundamentally different. So what they're doing may come closer and closer to like mocking or sort of mimicking
Looking.
human products, mocking us too,
Well,
probably.
yes.
We become obsolete. The AI will probably start mocking us behind our back, mimicking human products. But I believe that distinction will always be there because the process will always be different.
And what I like about this conversation, Adam, is that I have this conversation with people who are philosophical but come at it from more of either the spiritual point of view or various ways. And what you're saying in effect is just that is all fine, but from a scientific watching how the brain operates and looking at how large projects like this are done, there is a role for human creativity. And I think that's really
Absolutely is.
affirming.
And I think in the end, the end of the story, as far as we can see, will be collaborative hybrid creation. So humans leveraging a lot of the things that AI is good at, but still providing the sort of fundamental seed or spark of a creative inspiration, and also the important human top-down evaluative sense of what's a good idea. Right. And I think that becomes more, in fact, those forms of creativity, I think, only become more valuable in humans.
I know because we've talked about it that your research allows for people to learn how they are creative. Let's talk about two things with the 5 minutes that we have left. The first one is, what are the benefits? Why would it be good for people other than being able to work with AI? Why would it be good for us to be able to better understand how our specific brain works with respect to our creative process?
I mean, I think it depends how far you want to kind of take the sci-fi and how much, the future is now. But I think we are seeing more and more that even direct interaction with the human brain, devices that interact directly with human brains are entering more into the public consciousness. They've actually been around quite a while. When Elon Musk does it, it gets a lot of press, but we've, you know, we th there have been brain-based prosthetic, limb control devices actually for some time. There's deep brain stimulation that is, effective for things like Parkinson's. And then there's, a lot of the stuff that my lab's involved in, which is non-invasive neurostimulation using things like TMS, other forms of electrical stimulation, as well as even focused ultrasound to interact with the workings of the brain. So what I guess one answer to your question is that the better we understand how human brains work, even if we're purely thinking from like, how can we make the machine human interface as creative as possible, right? We still really need to understand the human side of that in order to build sort of optimal human machine collaborations. But I also think, pointing to the differences, right, and the uniqueness of human creativity, I think deeper understanding of our process as humans and how it differs from the creativity that can at least be mimicked by large language models will lead us more and more to identify which aspects of creativity cannot, in any near-term scenario, be replaced.
That sounds to me, when people say, well, it's all about the human spirit, it's about the soul, it's about the infinite, which many of, I'm sure, our colleagues believe very clearly. What's your answer to them? How does what you're doing relate to concerns about humanity and spirituality?
I don't think it has to concern anyone who, might worry about those things. I don't think we become whatever the soul means to you, it should continue to mean that, just exactly that. And I think it comes back to the idea, to the Ferrari idea, right? So a soul can be a beautiful, ephemeral, abstract concept, and you can appreciate it in all its fullness and mystery and beauty, but simultaneously seek to understand it, or just know, right, and sort of take on board that there are those who are seeking to understand it, right? So understanding how a Ferrari works doesn't make it any less beautiful or any less fast or any less enjoyable to drive. So if we as neuroscientists understand things in physical ways that have historically been referred to as soul or spirit, those things are still soul and those things are still spirit. They're still a Ferrari and they're still beautiful. But to those of us with, you know, scientific inquiring minds, understanding those things is also its own kind of beauty.
So I'll tell you, Adam, we spent 24 minutes together. We started with Ferraris, we ended with Ferraris, and I think you also gave probably the best description I've ever heard of how science and spirituality actually can coexist and benefit from each other. So thank you for sharing all you did. This was Adam Green, professor at Georgetown University. He's director of Laboratory for Relational Cognition. Adam, thank you for spending time with us today. It was absolutely terrific.
Thanks, Jonathan. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me.
This program is brought to you in partnership with George Mason University's Center for Regional Analysis. The CRA is the region's leading voice in economic data and forecasting. Check out their work at cra.gmu.edu. What's Working in Washington is a team effort. Our executive producer and editor is Tracy Madigan. Our assistant producer is Anna DeGraff. The theme music you've been listening to is performed by the Sunbathers. And thanks to all of you for joining us on What's Working in Washington.
You've been listening to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.